Next, oh, okay. No, yep. Okay. Next on the agenda is 2017-2018 number 108. Maybe just hit the microphone button there. Is there a button down there?
It says push. Now
go.
I'm on?
Yep.
Okay.
You sound on.
We try that again. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. My name is Edward Ramey, and I am representing the objectors here today. What I'd like to do, if this is okay with the board and okay with Mr. Dunn, who I know is representing the proponents, is deal with all these measures together, 108 through 113. They're all somewhat variations on a theme, and our arguments, therefore, are somewhat variations on the theme. We may at some point want to break them down because there are some differences and focus on particular impact on one measure versus as distinguished from another. But if that's okay with the board.
Is that okay with you, Mr. Dunn? It's really okay.
Okay.
I'm fine with it.
We have two basic objections. One is single subject, and the other one that seems to always go with that is that the hidden subjects are not adequately disclosed in the title. When dealing with single subject, each of these measures, what I'm going to try to demonstrate to the board, do address separate and distinct purposes. There's a common concept between all six of these measures, which is easily identifiable. It amends Article 2, Section 15 of the, each one of them amends Article 2, Section 15 of the Constitution, deals with takings and damage, by the way, which are different things, which I'll talk about in a moment. But there are purposes embedded in here, which are separate and distinct, and in all cases, I count at least two, and I can probably go up to four or five, and one or two of them, and I'll do that, though two is sufficient for the point. Speaking of single subject here, not talking about the log rolling, Christmas treeing kind of thing. There was some discussion or suggestion of that this morning, and it seems to usually be the source of the basis of single subject arguments. This one is focused much more, matter of fact, almost exclusively on the what is identified as the evil to be combated, which is surreptitious purposes coiled up in the folds, which is a term I love, sounds like a serpent, but coiled up in the folds of the measures. And these measures are almost classic in that regard. Classic examples of separate surreptitious, and I don't mean that in a negative way, except just surreptitious, coiled up in the folds that if the voters were aware of them, they would be surprised by the implication. If I may, I'm going to be relatively brief here, but let me sort of frame where this argument is going with a couple cases in the past that the Supreme Court has dealt with. Coming out of the title board, dealing with coiled up in the folds issues. And the first, there were this kind of set that I would like to talk about. There were a series of cases back in the late 90s involved in the wake of Tabor involving its application in a number of different fashions. And one case that I think was kind of the last in line was a case named Otselt v. Bruce. And I think I'm mispronouncing his last name. It's O-U-T-C-E-L-T, and I was corrected on that once years ago. But I'm going to give a few citations just so they're on the record. At 961 P. Second 456, that was a 1998 case. What the measures, and there were two, as I recall, in that case, did was require a reduction in local tax revenues and required the state to backfill to the local governments state revenue to fill the purposes that were no longer being funded by the reduced local revenue and required the state to do that within the spending and revenue limits established by Tabor. Argument was that contained a single subject. The Supreme Court said it did not, and the surprising serpent in that case coiled up in the folds was that by requiring the state to backfill local revenues within its own spending and revenue limits, it was necessarily requiring the state to move money out of other programs. Therefore, deplete the spending on other programs and put it in this sort of backfill operation for local governments. Now, you could say that, well, that was just an effect of the measure, but the Supreme Court was very clear that even though it was an effect of the measure as drafted, it rose to the level of being a surreptitious purpose, and the voters would be very surprised to learn, while they may be just fine with the idea of reducing local taxation and making the state backfill it, they would be very surprised to learn that the money for the backfill was coming out of other programs. Another case, there's only one more that I'll kind of mention that kind of demonstrates the coiled up in the folds concept even better, I think, is Gonzalez-Estai v. Lamb, and that is 138 P. 3rd, 273. It's a 2006 case. In that case, the measure was quite short, and in fact, of the three little paragraphs in the measure, only one was really the operative paragraph, and it read as follows. Except as mandated by federal law, the provision of non-emergency services by the state of Colorado or any county, city, or other political subdivision thereof is restricted to citizens and aliens lawfully present in the United States of America, period. Very short, very compact, and seemingly on its surface like a single subject, or just containing a single subject. Supreme Court opined otherwise very clearly and said, no, there really are two subjects here. One, it is directed at welfare and benefits services, which seems to be the first thing that you would see. But there's also a hidden purpose in here, which effectively by the language of this measure, irrespective of what the motivation of the proponents may or may not have been, by the language of this measure would also prohibit availing oneself of basic governmental services that are available to everybody and maybe transactional in nature. And they gave examples of things like access to the courts or dispute resolution mechanisms, licensing, or even executing and recording a deed, which benefits people more than just the non-citizen, unlawful alien, as they put it, present in the country, but also benefits other people. Court decided that voters might be surprised that that was the effect and an additional purpose of this, and it was hidden and not disclosed, and therefore there were two subjects. So that's sort of the context that I'm looking at, that I'm sort of looking at this in. These measures go even further. What they do, each one of them, Madam Chair, should I go on?
Sure.
Okay.
No, this is very routine.
Looked like there was a technical adjustment going on. Each one of these measures purports to amend Article 2, Section 15 of the Constitution in a different way, but in each way they impact and, in fact, wholly eviscerate the way they are worded, the meanings of the two other sort of contexts that exist in Article 2, Section 15 now, and that is the idea of a taking and the concept of damage. And we cited some cases in our motion, but there's even a better case, and I apologize to the board for not having it included in the motion, but it's probably the most recent, though not all that recent, and sums up the Colorado Supreme Court's understanding of how takings law under the Colorado Constitution works. And that case is Animas Valley Sand and Gravel versus Board of County Commissioners. Citation of that, again, for the record, is 38 P. 3rd, 59. That's a 2001 case that had to do with imposition of a land use plan by the county in that case that the sand and gravel company was not happy with. It's a lengthy discussion in there. The opinion came down right in the wake of a Supreme Court decision a few months earlier, which was sort of readdressing and redefining takings law under the Fifth Amendment. And in an opinion by Chief Justice Malarkey at the time, trying to sort of deal with takings at, under the Colorado Constitution and takings under the United States Constitution, her point was that the state pretty much tracks for the takings purposes, not damage, but for the takings purposes, pretty much tracks the federal law. And the federal law has evolved and changed, and I'll mention in a minute, but the Colorado law sort of goes with it. And that defines what constitutes a taking in Colorado. The concept of damage, which is also mentioned a word or two later in Article 2, Section 15, is something a little bit different. She explains that in the opinion as well. And there are other opinions that discuss this as well. And that generally is the same kind of concept, but it has to do with some physical encroachment on property due to something being carried out on a neighboring or abutting property. The examples of damage cases, but, which I also should say, by the way, that does not appear in the federal constitution. The damage claim is unique to the Colorado Constitution, and Justice Malarkey discusses that. examples where you see that are in things, is a case, for example, where a governmental entity had a water storage facility on its property and it leaked somehow underground onto the affected property, and that would constitute damage, though perhaps not a taking. Also, some of the aircraft overflight cases around airports, the Denver airports in particular, we see takings complaints every now and again by neighbors, and they tend to come into that damage sort of thesis, whether they're successful or not. Generally, they have not been. Under both of the concepts, and I should also should say what we're dealing with here today is regulatory taking. Adoption of a law, regulation, or regulatory condition in any of these measures that have an effect on a person's property, apparently real or personal property. and that's a regulatory taking that kind of falls, that does not fall in the damage category. Usually it's in the takings category and tracks federal law. Justice Malarkey and the court have been very clear, and the Animas Valley Sand and Gravel case is a good one. The other cases that we cited follow the same mode. The Krupp case appeared earlier that year and recited all the same propositions. There are two pedestals, to borrow a Trump phrase, if I may. There are two pedestals, at least, which are primary. Barring that phrase from the State of the Union, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. I was like,
but I've only got two. I don't have four pedestals for immigration policy today. But I do have the two concepts, the two propositions, the two pedestals upon which regulatory takings law in particular have stood from time immemorial, though the wording has changed over time, but these two pedestals have always been there, are basically as follows. On the one hand, taking compensation under a takings clause has the purpose of assuring that some people alone do not have to bear the public burdens of a law or regulation that is adopted for the benefit of the public. The idea is there is some unique effect, some unique burden, something that's different in kind, not just in amount, we'll get to that in a moment, not just in economic impact, but different in kind from what other members of the public would bear. For example, if my property is taken or subjected to some regulation that is directed to my property or a kind of property owned by a relatively small group of people and it's done for the public benefit, that could conceivably be a taking. However, if a law of general applicability is passed, say that property taxes are increased, a mill levy increase occurs, whatever you might want to say, a regulation or law is passed that affects everybody in the same manner, even though some people with larger pieces or smaller pieces of property may be affected monetarily differently, if it's a generally applicable law in kind for everybody, that is not a taking. It has to be the sort of thing where, in fairness and justice, if we're going to enact this law we, a purpose of this is, this law is to affect, impact certain types of property or property ownership by the nature of it. And irrespective of amount, it's just unfair and unjust to let those people bear the burden of the public benefit. So that's one of the pedestals. Second pedestal is simply a quantum one. And the courts have stated over and over, and these statements appear in the Animas Valley case. And actually, before I go to that one, let me just actually quote the Animas Valley case, because me paraphrasing a Chief Justice invariably falls short. So now I'm going to directly quote the opinion in Animas Valley. So takings, and I'm on page 63 for the record of that opinion, takings jurisprudence balances the competing goals of compensating landowners on whom a significant burden of regulation falls and avoiding prohibitory costs to needed government regulation. The takings clause, she goes on to say, assures that government may not force some people alone to bear public burdens, which in all fairness and justice should be borne by the public as a whole. And then, quoting an old Supreme Court case, she states, government hardly could go on if to some extent values incident in property could not be diminished without paying for every such change in general law. So there has to be sort of a focused impact and injustice we don't saddle particular people with. The second burden, and by the way, she was quoting a U.S. Supreme Court opinion that she tracks, the Palazzolo case, which I will give a cite to, too, just for the record, 533 U.S. 606 201, which said exactly the same thing from a federal takings perspective. So that's one pedestal. It's sort of that unique impact pedestal. The second pedestal of takings has always been a quantum one. And this has been worded in all kinds of different ways, and from one that's quoted in our motion, which is, there was a time when to have a takings, it basically had to deprive the property owner of all use whatsoever of the property. I'm having watched the law evolve, I would suggest, if I were in a court where that were the issue, that that's probably not the standard anymore. And Justice Malarkey talks about that, because you now get deprivation and reasonable investment expectations and all kinds of other sort of large impact measurements applied. But here's what the Colorado Supreme Court says about that in the same opinion on page 65. Although the Palazzolo court, she was trying to be consistent with it, did not address what level of interference a government regulation must have caused to constitute taking under a fact-specific inquiry, a mere decrease in property value is not enough. And she goes on to say that the level of interference, however you measure it, must be very high. So there is a quantum. You have to have a significant value monetary impact to rise to the level of a taking, even if the first pedestal that you're singling out, this property, is satisfied. So incidental, the fact that I own a piece of property and there's some regulation happens to impact me a bit more, it's got to be a high impact before I can complain of a taking. Now, that's the way the law exists presently. So with that, let me go to these measures. And they really fall into three categories. Number 108 stands by itself. And what number 108 does is it adds a category to that didn't exist before in Article 2, Section 15. The way it read before was, private property shall not be taken, with the pedestals and everything we just discussed. And my copy says reads of damaged, but I'm sure it's supposed to mean or damaged, which is that separate adjacent property concept, which still has the two pedestal support. Or, and now we add a new concept, or reduced in fair market value by government law or regulation. So by adding or reduced in fair market value by government law or regulation, I would suggest to the board that we have completely eviscerated both of the conceptual pedestals of what a taking or damage to property is. Not only, number one, we've added a new category. There's a subject, this reduction. But by doing that, the idea of everything that's inherent in the body of law about what a taking is and what a damage is under Colorado law is gone. It does not need to focus on a particular burden piece of property, so it's unfair to have this person shoulder the value for the public benefit. And there is no quantum measurement at all, just a reduction in fair market value. Those are at least two other subjects. And they're not just effects, they're subjects. They're clearly intended. And again, going by the wording, those are two purposes manifest in the wording of that measure. Now, three of the other measures do it differently. Each of these tries a different approach to this. Numbers 109, 110, and 112 all in different ways redefine the concept of damage. In this case, they don't add a new category, but they redefine damage. Number 109 says that property, this is the added language, private property is damaged when a government law or regulation reduces the fair market value of the property by at least 10%. So, number one, there's no reference to the adjacent property physical damage concept that exists. Number two, the pedestal about an unfair or focused burden on a particular property owner is gone. It doesn't exist there. The unfairness of burdening one property owner or a group of property owners for a general public benefit. And there is a quantum in here, but it's 10%. It sure as the Dickens doesn't fit within the very large or anything even approaching that category of takings and damage under the existing body of law. So we've redefined damage and essentially gutted the whole concept of taking at the same time. Because if you have this, we've defined damage as being a reduction in the fair market value by 10%. So there's at least two, I might argue three subjects there. And the most troubling one that's coiled up in the folds is the way that the redefinition of damage has eviscerated completely the body of case law upon which the concept of taking rests. If you go to 110, it's done a little bit differently. It says property shall be deemed damage. So, I mean, this is not just changing an element. This is property shall now be deemed damaged when a government law or regulation reduces a property's fair market value by prohibiting or restricting uses allowable at the time the owner acquired title to the property. No unfair focused effect and no quantum of measurement other than simply depreciation of the value of the property or diminution of the value of the property, which is exactly what takings law does not recognize. The last one of that category is 112, which does the same thing. Again, slightly differently, property will be deemed damaged whenever the state or any government entity or property, when any law, regulation, or regulatory condition that limits or prevents property from being used for all of the purposes allowable at the time the owner acquired title. So again, we've now redefined what a damage is, and by doing that, we've eviscerated everything in the takings provision itself as the law currently recognizes it. The third category of these measures includes 111 and 113, the other ones, and what they do is redefine the concept of taking. So here, they're not talking about damage, they haven't added a category, they're going straight to the takings clause, which is at least getting closer to not hiding something in the folds, and I don't mean this to be accusatory of Mr. Dunn, but the effect of what this language does, particularly with those other two categories, is hide something in the folds. It doesn't even look like it has anything to do with the takings measure here. At least they're addressing the takings measure. But by redefining a taking in we take 111 as implementation by the state or any government entity or agency of any law or regulation operates to reduce the fair market value of property for uses allowable at the time the owner acquired title. By doing that, again, they've knocked both of the pedestals of traditional law of taking down. It's not just a quantum measurement of fair market value measured within a time frame having to do with once allowable uses. It also completely eviscerates the concept there has to be something special about the focus so that it's unfair to burden these property owners for the benefit of the public. That pedestal's gone. And the last measure is 113, which does a similar thing. Whenever the state or any government entity or agency enacts a law, regulation, or regulatory condition, a bit broader, that operates to reduce the fair market value of property for uses allowable to time the owner acquired title. So again, changes both, knocks both pedestals out from under the taking definition. So in both of those cases, there are at least two subjects, neither of which are disclosed in the titles. None of this, nothing I've been talking about is disclosed in the titles. And we would have a lot of work, I think, to do with the titles to get this stuff disclosed. But two major concepts of taking. These measures demonstrate a clear purpose to eviscerate, eliminate not just one, but both of them, and totally change the concept of taking. And I said four of them do it under terminology that doesn't even suggest taking. One of them at least talks about it taking. So that is our purpose. That is our main objection. That is our primary objection. We're doing a lot of things. These are hidden purposes. Very much coiled up in the folds. They are not all apparent from the measures, not at all apparent unless you read the cases and follow the cases and the body of law that defines what these operative concepts are and do it in a way that I could suggest certainly could surprise voters. A voter may be perfectly fine, for example, this almost sounds like log rolling, but it's not since these are hidden so well. It can barely be called log rolling, but a voter might be perfectly fine with saying, look, I think a de minimis effect on property value should be enough to constitute a taking, but I do think it somehow has to be unfair to shoulder this person with it. Otherwise, we can have a new generally applicable law that affects property values generally. We're all going to pay each other, I guess, because we've all had our property taken for each other's benefits. So, I mean, it's, that might make sense. The other thing, somebody might say, look, I'm okay with getting rid of the fairness and the inequitable impact pedestal, but I want the value to stay high. I mean, I think to have a taking, this has got to be real stuff. It can't be nickel and diming that I have to pay slightly higher flood control and drainage fee next year than I did this year because of some government law or regulation or because some electric code got modified. I don't think we all should be able to bring takings claims, but somebody who really is impacted by it may. But right now, both those pedestals exist, and the effect upon both of them, frankly, is hidden. So I will stop at this point. I'm sure Mr. Dunn has a bit to say, but that's the nature of our objections. And by the way, if we were to find single subject here, I'd respectfully suggest we got to go into the titles, and these titles are going to get a whole lot longer because everything I just talked about has to be disclosed. Those, the basic pedestals of the concept which define the law that we're dealing with here, have and the effect of these on that would have to be addressed at least in an understandable fashion in the titles. Thank you.
Anyone have any questions before we have Mr. Gunn?
Yeah, before I sit down.
Okay. Why don't you come on up?
Good afternoon. Jason Dunn on behalf of the proponents, Michelle Smith and Chad Vorthman, who are both here for the record. I thought that was a well spelled out history of takings law in Colorado. Actually, that was pretty interesting.
Put in for a CLE.
That's right. I mean, I get some CLE credit out of that. But I don't think it changes the single subject analysis at all. And what struck me is that I think the answer to Mr. Ramey's argument is, to steal a phrase, coiled up in the folds of his own argument. He kept referring to the two pedestals of takings law. And I think in a way that's probably right. There are the takings law has pedestals, and I would say it's two pedestals of the same chair, but I'm not familiar with a two-legged chair, so I won't use that analogy, but maybe two pedestals of the same, whatever, statuette, the same structure. And it answers the question. They're both connected and part of the same thing. And that is the constitutional definition of what constitutes as taking and when it's compensable. So, I don't think it's necessary to respond to the case law or the individual arguments, but rather just to say that I think the changes all fit within the single subject of amending the definition or description of what constitutes a taking under the Colorado Constitution. They all fit within in that single subject and are all that are necessary and properly connected to that. Maybe the best way to respond is to say, if we had proposed a measure that struck the entire Article 2 itself, I don't think anyone would argue that that was a single subject, or I should say Article 2, Section 15. If we struck that entire provision in its entirety, I don't think anyone would contend that that had more than one subject. But really, that would have the same effect as what Mr. Ramey is arguing. So I think I'll stop there and see if there's any questions.
Any questions? No. Okay. Thanks. Start? You want me to start?
I can start, I guess. You know, looking at these, it seems like they do, to me, have a single subject, which is, you know, the fact that Mr. Ramey said that these are not just effects. I think they very much are just effects. The board has said titles before, and the court's upheld it on things like concerning a public trust doctrine for water, which completely altered what would have altered water law, I believe. We had an even broader one, I think, concerning a public right to the environment. That was upheld. I can't see how these, what their effects are narrow. I mean, it's a fairly narrow area of law generally. It's, as Mr. Dunn put it, I think, you know, under what circumstances is property, does government do something affecting property in a way that requires compensation? And this wants to broaden the scope of when compensation is required. And that's it.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with that. And I think that the fact that there will obviously be a whole new body of case law, and maybe some case law will no longer be relevant, and there will be new litigation, doesn't mean it's two subjects. That's pretty common from any initiative that goes through the board. Whether something is going to be upheld as constitutional with all the other provisions isn't even in the purview of this board. And so I think those kinds of legal arguments, while correct and valid, don't make two subjects. And to the extent that the voters would be surprised, I quite frankly think the voters would be surprised to know there's this body of case law that has these pedestals. And when they look at takings law, or when you talk to people about takings law, non-lawyers, they don't seem to, really have much background in terms of what you have to show for neighboring parties and, how the amount is arrived at and that kind of thing. And so I'm not sure that that would be a surprise to the voters that this would be done somehow differently than a body of case law. And so I'm not sure that I see that argument either. And I think that this just simply adds another category, and that may require a whole new calculation and new arguments, but it's still just requiring a new category.
And I don't think I have anything to add.
Okay.
We just to check, despite the R, we'll do these one at a time.
Let's take these.
Do think we should do it one at a time because there are slight differences.
Right. Especially if we're going to get into whether the titles need
work.
And there could be arguments on those.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18 number 108 to the extent that it claims that we lack jurisdiction because of multiple subjects, and find that we have jurisdiction to keep or consider the title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. So let's take the title and then we'll just move to the next one. Mr. Ramey.
Well, this was the exercise I wish we didn't have to get into. But so here's what I would suggest on 108. Let me just throw this out, and we can open it. Mr. Dunn will certainly want to comment, and we can open this for discussion. What it says right now, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution requiring the government to award just compensation, which I will just note, though our objection isn't based on this, probably a catchphrase, to owners of private property when a government law or regulation reduces the fair market value of the property. I think I would suggest that the public is entitled to know the effect of adding this new category on the other components of Article 2, Section 15. And that language roughly along the following lines would have to be added, probably after the end of that fair market value of the property. Something like this, bear with me, and we can go back piece by piece, but bear with me as I read it. Eliminating the current constitutional requirement that a property owner suffer a significant burden through imposition of the law or regulation, that in fairness and justice should be borne by the public as a whole rather than that property owner, and eliminating the current constitutional requirement that the level of interference with the property owner's use of his property caused by the law or regulation must be large. Now we can break that down into pieces, but to be fairly disclosing to the public what the Dickens 108 is doing, that's what it's doing. It's gutting the rest of the measure in those two fashions. And I would think fair disclosure, the trap we get into here, fair disclosure requires the public be informed of that and at least that basic foundation of the law that they're voting upon.
So would it really do that? I mean, all it does is says, in addition to the prohibition on taking and the prohibition on damage, there's also, maybe I shouldn't call it a prohibition, but the requirement that there be compensation. It also says if it's reduced in fair market value, there's compensation. So as far, with respect to 108, as far as the taking or the damaged, presumably those requirements could still stay in force and whatever case law applies to those terms. This would just be adding an additional third category. That why would that necessarily, I mean, as a practical matter, maybe it would, people would choose this one instead of claiming a taking or a damage, but why would it necessarily affect the interpretation or case law relating to those other two categories?
Well, and that, Mr. Roper, you just nailed, again, reflected back to me, I think going back to the single subject argument, though not remaking it, that's already been voted upon. But the addition of that third category is not a standalone category. By its existence, as long as the fair market value is reduced by government law or regulation, we're done. So the other two categories don't have any meaning anymore. And this is why I'm trying to say this is more than an effect. We can say that this is an effect. I don't mean to re-argue the single subject, but my point is it's killing off the other two sections.
But I'm not sure that's true, because in an exercise of eminent domain, for example, the government can come in and actually take ownership of the property. And that would certainly not be eviscerated by the addition of this third category.
Well, I think what it does, Mr. Roper, is anything, whether it's a physical taking, whether it's a regulatory taking of some sort, a regulatory condition that's imposed on the property, anything you might want to name that reduces the fair market value of that property. I don't care where it's coming from, whether it's coming from a physical encroachment from neighboring property, a regulatory condition, a seizure of the property because they want to build a public parking lot on your property, whatever the dickens it might be, is all that's required now is a reduction in fair market value, any reduction in fair market value. So the other two categories have essentially become meaningless. Now, that's why I think there are multiple subjects here, but again, putting that aside, the board has voted on that. The fact that those conditions are gone as a practical matter, because all I have to do is come in and show that here is a regulation and it's reduced the fair market value of my property. I'm done.
Why would I prove a taking? Yeah, but I think that's really the point, is you're saying as a practical matter. Now, there's nothing that says that you can't go in and do a condemnation. It's just the point is sort of why would you?
That's
right.
Well,
I mean, if you're a landowner, sure, yeah, why would you? But it doesn't take away the fact that you could. I mean, that's why I think it's an effect, because it still exists on the books. It's just that this is probably so much more beneficial to the landowner that they wouldn't bother with the great body of case law and the things you have to prove and going through that process of the pedestals.
That's right? Why I think I shouldn't have used that word, but that's why I think everything you just said, Madam Chair, is absolutely correct. But that's why what that language has done is make the concepts of taking and damage utterly superfluous. It's more than just an effect. I mean, it's basically repealed. It hasn't repealed them. They're sitting there. But there is no conceivable reason to use them. You're going to have to show a reduction in fair market value anyway. That's the measure of the compensation that you get. So you're going to show that. You're done. Not one other thing do you need to show. And at a minimum, if we're going to find it all, it's all one subject, you get to do that. At least that needs to be disclosed to the voters in this measure.
Well, it seems to me, at least on this one, that you do have to show something else. You have to show that the reduction in fair market value was caused by government law or regulation, not because government, for example, built a new headquarters for CDOT that encroached on your property and blocked your views and reduced your value. If I see that, that doesn't fall under this measure. That falls under maybe damaged under existing law, which is unchanged.
Well, I think, Mr. Gellner, I would suggest, I don't mean to get this debate going too deeply, be like a graduate seminar here, but the concept of regulatory taking is part of takings. So takings includes not only seizure of someone's property or the government coming in and saying, I'm going to physically take it. We're going to build a highway here. We're going to build a parking lot, a headquarters here or whatever. The regulatory takings concept exists under taking. So this is a restatement of the regulatory takings concept, and it swallows everything else in Article 2, Section 15 utterly.
But I think I just gave an example where it doesn't swallow everything utterly. And the rest of the argument just seems like you're saying, you know, this initiative changes the law. Well, they all do, right? Hmm. I mean.
Okay. I mean, I do see your point. That, I would think, though, would need at a minimum what we're talking about now be disclosed in the context of a regulatory taking, not to go back into the single subject analysis, but in the context of a regulatory taking, which is a huge part of takings, we now have a new animal. And if you're dealing with anything that results, it's actually broader than a regulatory taking, because it says by any government law. So any government law or regulation that reduces the fair market value of property, anything, is now compensable by that amount, period. There is no reason to go into either of the other two categories as long as there is a law or regulation being implicated.
Right, and I think you just made a point. If a government law regulation is being implicated, which is what we state in the title, is doing the job, then we don't go to the other two categories. If a governmental law or regulation is not part of it, then the other two categories continue to apply as they have been.
But again, I would come back, shouldn't that be, we're getting into a debate, sure. But shouldn't that be disclosed? That when we are dealing with a law or regulation.
Well, that's exactly what the title says, isn't it? When a government law or regulation reduces the fair market value of the property. So we've disclosed it when it's there, and when it's not there, we don't have to disclose it because nothing's changing.
Okay. I'm not convinced, but I'm taking your point.
All right. Anything else? No?
And I would, I guess, make a motion that we deny the motion for rehearing in its entirety.
Well, I
don't know if we need to give Mr. Dunn an opportunity to speak as to this, or if he.
I was going to say I'm fine with getting rid of just compensation.
Okay.
But
I'll withdraw the motion for now. Then leave room for discussion.
I'm not in favor of, the rewrite as he suggested, but I do think that just compensation, and I think I probably brought this up last time, is problematic for me. I think it could be a catchphrase. It makes it sound like it's the right thing to do. So I don't know if anybody wants to talk about that. I think we could just say compensation. Or something like that. I just don't think just adds anything to it, and it's potentially a problem, but it won't stop me from voting favorably on the rehearing. So. Mr. Dunn, you want to be heard on that?
Sure, Jason Dunn. The only thing I would say is that I think it's important that the public understand that it's not just any compensation or a nominal compensation decided by the governmental entity, but it must be just compensation. So there may be another phrase to adequately express that. Maybe fair compensation, but that could arguably be a catchphrase. Just compensation is, of course, the phrase used in the Constitution. So I know that the board often falls back to using the language of the measure of the Constitution itself when in doubt. But I do think it needs some sort of modifier on compensation to indicate that it's more than just whatever they decide they want to pay for it, but rather that it's an amount that's based on something else. In this case, the concept of just compensation and how that's determined.
I mean, if you want to leave it, that's fine, too. I just am not sure that that term's very helpful to voters. I don't think they know what that means. But
I mean, I think what I'd say is I think it's a term of art, but I don't think it's a catchphrase. You know, I don't think it's – I'm not convinced it's persuasive. It is the language in the Constitution. I think we're fairly on a – I think we're on a pretty sort of legally risk-free basis using it. As far as helpfulness to the voters, I mean, I think we could say something, you know, compensation, you know, calculated as required by law or something like that. But I think we'll need a few more words if we want to do something different.
I'd be fine either way, either leaving it or modifying it if we can find the right fit. And I don't have a suggestion as to what that might be. Jason's could work for me.
We can leave it.
No, it's your issue, Madam Chair.
I'm just not sure fair really. I mean, I guess, Mr. Ramey, do you have any just fair between fair and just
that
do anything for you?
I mean, I didn't raise this in my motion, so I feel a little awkward arguing it vehemently at this point. But I think we could raise it at the hearing. I mean, that's kind of the way it's been viewed. I think either fair or just would be would risk catchphrase concerns. And you know, this, I mean, there it is. I'll just kind of leave it at that. I will comment on one thing. There is law, and I wish I had a compendium of all the title board cases that have gone to the Supreme Court in my head, and I don't. But one I do remember, in particular, 258A from many years ago, just because the language appears in the measure does not, transferring it into a title does not isolate it from catchphrase. And that was the English language learning measure, where the measure said our purpose is to teach children to speak English as rapidly and effectively as possible. And it was the exact words. There was no embellishment of it. Went into the title and boom, it was the catchphrase. And the court was very clear that just because it's in the measure, that doesn't shield you from the problem. So I tend to agree with Madam Chair's concern that there's a catchphrase there. But, I mean, there are other issues obviously swimming around which are far greater in my view.
This strikes me as a little different because just compensation is already in the Constitution and not just part of the measure that's being proposed.
Well, but, I mean, the problem is you can put whatever you want in your title, like, you know. I mean, we had that debate on the education measure that Mr. Ramey brought earlier this session about, you know, if a measure says this is to provide the best world-class education so our children can succeed, we don't put that in the title. But it might be in the measure, and I don't think it necessarily shields it. I mean, I would have said fair was okay with me, but if Mr. Ramey doesn't think it really does anything one way or the other, I think we're probably better off using the language in the measure than we are using a different word that he thinks is as problematic. So, you know, otherwise, I think we'd have to go with, you know, a few more words and say as calculated or whatever that suggestion was. But I guess I just, you know, Mr. Ramey brought it up at the hearing. I brought it up last time and just kind of wanted to put my thoughts out there on it. But if you all feel fine with it, then I'm okay just leaving the title.
Well, I, to be clear, I think I'm okay with it as it is, but I'd also be okay if there's, I'm not sure that fair, I don't know that I like fair compensation better than what we have. But Suzanne, if you have something.
Well, I think we would just do in a manner prescribed by law, which is what trails in Section 15 of the Constitution. Because I don't know that we want to dive into the case law and determine what that has been.
Right. And I'd be okay adding something like that. It would be a few more words, but this one isn't particularly long.
Are we having a motion to add just compensation as determined in the manner prescribed by law? Is that essentially?
Well, I was going to just say compensation in a manner.
Right.
Yeah. Get rid of just, which is
yes.
The problem word. Yeah, Mr. Dunn.
You know, I would argue that it's adequate as is, because what constitutes compensation and how it's calculated is already in Section 2, Article 15. Section 15 of Article 2. So it says such compensation shall be ascertained by a board of commissioners, et cetera, et cetera. So nothing about that is being changed. So I don't think it's necessary to modify just compensation by spelling out what's already in the Constitution.
It's fine, I mean.
What motion would you like me to make?
Well, I mean, if you want to leave it, I mean, you know, okay. He's the one who has to defend it. So.
Fair enough. I move that we deny the motion for rehearing on initiative 2017-18 number 108 in its entirety.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, that takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018 number 109, and we'll of course incorporate your prior legal education seminar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to read that phrase again unless I've requested specifically to do it, in which case I'm happy to. This is a little different. I want to go back to, I guess, the comment before is here in 108, we're just adding this new category that has to do particularly with regulatory takings. Here we're doing something else. We're redefining the concept of damage so that now a property is damaged when a government law or regulation, so we're still talking regulatory, reduces the fair market value of the property by at least 10%. As the law stands today, we not only have my two pedestals that support the damage concept, but damage also is limited to that adjacent property concept. It's gone here now under this definition, that as long as we have a reduction in fair market value of at least 10%, we're damaged. And I'm not going to repeat all the arguments that also reaches into the takings body of law with regard to regulatory takings, but it utterly changes what damage now is. No longer does it involve this adjacent property aspect whatsoever. Now it absorbs a regulatory taking concept that is directly applicable to the property being affected, and at least 10%, and that's all it takes. And so I would reiterate that those two awful provisions that I read before, and would be happy to read again if requested, but I think that would need to be disclosed.
Anything, Mr. Dunn?
For the record, Jason Dunn on behalf of proponents Michelle Smith and Chad Borthman, who are here. That was my primary point of coming up, just to
tell us they're still here.
I will just simply incorporate the arguments from 108. I think nothing is that Mr. Ramey said changes the response to those, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Do you want to do single subject first and then?
I think we could just do the motion then.
Okay. Do we think there's anything more persuasive about the arguments in this context versus in the last one we had a separate category in the sense, well, actually, I'm going to stop. Sorry. Single subject, just make the motion.
Go ahead.
Conflating it with the title changing.
Oh.
I move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18 number 109 to the extent it claims multiple subjects.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. So on the title.
On the title, I think he does have a point about it is changing or redefining to some extent what constitutes damage under the Constitution, and I don't think that aspect of it is captured in our title. Because we just say it's establishing that private property is damaged. So I don't think he. We've heard Mr. Ramey propose some new language, but I'd be willing to consider adjusting something about the way we have it phrased to indicate that it is a redefinition or specification as to what constitutes damage. I don't know how you two feel about.
I guess my first question would be is, do you feel as though some sort of specific notice is given, or more like a, just a general notice that there is sort of an existing definition that we're modifying?
The latter is
sufficient.
Yeah.
Okay. We can probably figure out how to do that.
So, we want to say expanding the definition, or you want to.
Or specifying that damage.
I mean, we could do a trailer too. We could just say an amendment concerning.
Madam Chair, could I add a piece of information?
Sure.
And I'm not sure I'm advocating this. I kind of, who's Mr. Dunn? Okay. I don't think I am, but I can give you the language right out of Animas Valley, where the court discusses the distinction between damage and taking. And I think what I'll do is I'm just going to dump it out here and wish the board and Mr. Dunn good luck with this. But what the court said is that, let me try and get this right. This court has interpreted the damage language in Colorado's takings clause to provide broader rights than does the federal clause, but only insofar as it allows recovery to landowners whose land has been damaged by the making of public improvements abutting their lands, but whose lands have not been physically taken by the government. That's the distinction. If there's some, I don't know how to get that in there, but it seems to me that that's a different concept and it's being materially morphed by this provision.
And I would not be inclined to get into any of that detail about how it's been interpreted. My only point was making clear that there is a, you know, that damage is already part of the Constitution, and this is just specifying that. You know, when there's a law or regulation that satisfied these requirements, that is specified to constitute damage. And maybe I'm the only one on the board who feels.
No, well, here's a thought. Steve, here's what I would suggest, is that we change it to read, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution expanding the circumstances in which private property is damaged, requiring just compensation, to include any situation in which, and then just going on with the government law as it is.
We just say to include when a government? I think we gotta say a situation. I guess short enough, I'm probably fine either way.
Mr. Dunn, any comment on that?
Well, I fall back on less is more. And I think that just adds verbiage that I'm not sure really changes what the title says, particularly the second change. The use of the phrase expanding the circumstances. I don't really view it as much as expanding circumstances as changing the definition or defining what constitutes a damage under the constitutional provision. If the idea, I was thinking before those changes were made, to get to Mr. Roper's point that maybe the easiest way, I think your point is that you want to somehow tie it back to, it's not just a concept in and of itself, but that it's part of the constitutional description of what's a taking. If that's true, then maybe the easiest thing was just to say an amendment to the Colorado Constitution establishing that private property is damaged, constituting a taking requiring just compensation. Just adding that little language right there before requiring so that it ties it into the takings definition. And maybe that achieves your purpose. But otherwise, I think it was fine as is. I think it makes it more confusing now for the voter than the way it was previously written.
Well, what if instead of establishing that private property is damaged, keep it as we had it and just say specifying that private property is damaged?
I'd be fine with that.
Trying to make clear that this is more of a specific statement as to what constitutes damage.
I'm fine with that.
And if we do that, then I think we get rid of this, my second change, and just replace the when with whenever, maybe.
And then on the first one, Stephen, instead of expanding the circumstances in which, just say specifying. Just specifying, not the rest of that red line. And maybe adding the that back in.
We're fine with that.
Plan is probably fine, right? There's no real difference there.
No, I'm fine with
that. Yeah, let's keep it as when.
So we have now, after all that, we have changed establishing to specifying. So now it reads an amendment to the Colorado Constitution specifying that private property is damaged, requiring just compensation when a government law or regulation reduces the fair market value of the property by 10% or more.
Thanks for humoring me. I'll go ahead and move that we deny the motion for rehearing for proposed initiative 2017-18, number 109, other than to the extent that we've changed the title as shown on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That takes us to proposed initiative number 2017-2018, number 110.
Madam Chair, I think the issue is the same. The argument's the same as what we've just gone through, because 110, again, it's a little different. Private property shall be deemed damaged when a government law or regulation reduces fair market value in those certain circumstances. But I think it's much the same issue that we just went through. So I'll stop with that. I would like the language. I'd love to have a chance to read it again that I read to you initially with regard to all the measures. But not hearing a request, I'll defer to the board to continue that discussion.
Mr. Dunn, you want to just establish your record that your clients didn't escape?
For the record, Jason Dunn, my clients did not escape, much to their chagrin. Michelle Smith and Chad Borthman are both here.
Okay, thank you.
And we're fine with the title as currently written.
Madam Chair, may I just a caution on one thing. Let me reincorporate all my arguments from before with regard to each of these measures. I'll do it specifically here, but if I forget, if we can incorporate backwards and forwards.
Yes, we'll and the board's comments will be incorporated as well as Mr. Dunn, so. All right, any comments?
I don't have any comments, and I'm comfortable with the language as it is.
Okay. Do you have anything, Jason?
I think since we have the taking context up above in this one in the separate single subject and trailer model, that we don't need to make a change like we did last time. So, yeah, I think we're fine.
All right. I'm going to make a motion, someone.
I would move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18, number 110, in its entirety.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, that takes us to proposed initiative number 2017-2018, number 111.
Madam Chair, with 111, we're getting to one of the measures that that redefines the concept of taking. Whenever implementation by the state of any government or state or any government entity or agency of any law or regulation operates to reduce fair market value of property for uses allowable. I think somewhere in here it says, oh, the property shall be deemed to have been taken for use by the public. Again, I would reincorporate my former comments. I think now that we're moving directly into the takings phrase as opposed to one of the other concepts, the public should be advised of the full scope of what they're doing and that awful language that I read really needs to be in the title.
Oh, Mr. Dunn, sorry.
Jason Dunn on behalf of proponents Michelle Smith and Chad Borthman, who are both here. And I'll incorporate my previous arguments.
All right.
I would move that we, we'll do it in both. First, I'd move that proposed initiative 2017-18 number, I move that we deny the motion to the rehearing to the extent that it alleges that proposed initiative 2017-18 number 111 has multiple subjects.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
On this one, do we want to replace Mr. Roper declaring with specifying on line 2? It seems to be a sort of similar situation.
I'd actually be fine either way on this one because of that. It has that preceding clause.
Okay.
I'd be fine either way.
Okay. In that case, I move that the board denies the motion for a rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18, number 111 in its entirety.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018, number 112.
Madam Chair, 112 is one of the redefinitions of the concept of damage, so I would incorporate my comments made with regard to whatever the other damage measures were. I think they were 109.
We started at 108.
Let me make sure. 108 was not one. 109, 110, and 112. So I would incorporate my comments with regard to 109 and 110.
All right. Oh, Mr. Dunn.
Jason Dunn on behalf of proponents Michelle Smith and Chad Borthman, who are both here. I'll incorporate my previous arguments on 109 as well.
Let's see. I don't think we have any need to do changes to the title, so I would move that we deny the motions for rehearing on the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18 number 112 in its entirety.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. That takes us to proposed initiative 2017-2018 number 113.
Madam Chair, 113 is one of the measures that changes the definition of a taking. So I would incorporate our comments with regard to measure number 111, which was similar in that regard.
Go ahead.
Jason Dunn on behalf of proponents Michelle Smith and Chad Borthman, who are both here, and I'll incorporate my previous arguments as well.
All right.
I move that we deny the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 2017-18 number 113 in its entirety.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right. That takes us to
payday.
Proposed initiative 2017-2018 number 126.
This is Julie subbing in for me just for this one.
Right, and the proponents. Oh, there you are. Okay.
There I am.
Ms. Tierney, you want to introduce your proponents and then we'll.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Martha Tierney on behalf of the proponents for initiative number 126, Corinne Fowler and the Reverend Dr. Annie Rice Jones, who are both present and have signed their affidavits.
Okay. All right. Do you want to just start out by telling us what the single subject of your measure is?
Yes, the single subject of the measure is reducing the charges imposed by payday lenders on payday loans.
Okay. Has anyone else signed up to speak on this one? Any questions from the board on the single subject?
Julie Pellegrin with the Office of Legislative Legal Services. The provision that's in 5.3.1.121 concerning the unfair and deceptive practices, that appears to be different to me than actually changing the charges or reducing the charges. That's where you are changing the language from engaging in an act that limits or restricts the application to engage in any device, subterfuge, or pretense to evade the requirements, and then adding also an example of what that could be. And I'm just curious as to how what that language is doing and how it relates to reducing the charges.
Sure. So the existing provision, what it does is spell out, flesh out what the a violation of the unfair and deceptive practices would be, which I don't think the original language did. In sufficient detail, so it is an I was going to say enforcement mechanism, but it's not really, it's a what violates this measure flowing straight out of the single subject of the measure. So as you can see contained within this section of the statute now, 5.3.1.121, or let's say Article 3.1 of Title V, is this unfair deceptive practices. Already it says person violates by engaging in any act that limits or restricts. This just makes it clearer what that exactly means.
Okay.
How you would violate the act.
Okay. I'm asking more along the lines of just my initial thought that perhaps it's a little broader than just reducing charges imposed. It's actually concerning limitations on payday lenders. In terms of
the in terms of the breadth of the
whether reducing charges imposed would include the changes that you're making
to
121.
I suppose we could. I'm sort of jumping to the title, which is what I think you're getting at. Reframe the very first single subject clause there. And what was the language you used?
I was just thinking limitations on payday lenders. Slightly broader, but I think still gets at what you're doing.
Well, that... And I don't think we would have concerns with that, but we would want then to make, to have the trailer make clear,
sure,
and to have a proposal on that, that the measure does reduce allowable charges, because I think the title as written doesn't tell voters whether or not we are increasing or reducing those limits.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But to your point about the unfair deceptive practices, if you think the single subject clause needs to be a little bit broader, we certainly would be willing to talk about that and work on that.
Okay, great.
Any other questions? No. Any discussion on single subject? No. You want to make a motion?
Sure. I move that as to propose initiative 2017-18 number 126, we find that it has a single subject and that the board has jurisdiction to set a title.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Madam Chair, before we move into discussing the actual title, I think there might be some technical corrections that we need to consider. When I was looking at the final, the as amended and the final that were turned in, and the changes made to 5.3.1.121. In response to what was in the memo, the memo originally it was striking out personal and striking the S on sale. Same with transaction, striking the S on transaction and then striking the S on rebate. But the way it came out, you can't see the change. I mean, what should be in the final draft here is the word sales, plural, in strike type, and the word sale in small caps. Same with transactions in strike type and transaction in small caps, and rebates in strike type and rebate in small caps. I think that was just probably an inadvertent error that occurred in trying to show the changes in the amended and then having them show up also in the final.
You may be right. We originally just struck the S's and were advised by legislative legal services or alleged counsel that proper drafting would be to strike the whole word and then retype it without the S.
Mm-hmm.
And my version shows that's how we did it, but I don't have the version in front of you, but I would accept that as if we could make a Scrivener's correction if that is what's showing in front of you.
Yeah, that's fine. Here, you can look at it if you want.
Sure.
All right, we need to move that change. So.
Okay, I move that, and I'm flying on this motion. I don't know how these motions are supposed to go, but I would move that we make a technical correction in the text of the measure 2017-18 initiative number 126. In the amendments to Section 5.3.1.121, it should read, let's see, the word personal is in strike type, the word sales plural should be in strike type, and the word sale should be in small caps. Do you see where we are? Mm-hmm. Transactions should be in strike type, and the word transaction singular should be in small caps. And on the next line, the word rebates should be in strike type, and singular rebate should be in small caps.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right. That takes us to the title. Ms. Tierney, did you have any comments on the staff draft?
I have a proposed change that I could pass around.
Thanks.
And it just goes to the point I was discussing a moment ago, that I don't think it makes clear that it's a reduction in charges. So we'd like to see that be made a little bit clearer, and that could either, if we're going to change the single subject clause to concerning I forgot how you framed it again.
Just taking out the words on the charges imposed by.
So limitations
on
payday lenders. But then after the in connection therewith, we'd like to see reducing allowable charges by prohibiting, so that it is clear that it is a reduction and not just a change in the limit, which could mean an increase.
I'm going to ask kind of a basic question. I mean, do you think we are to the point where people know what a payday lender is?
Well,
I think that's an okay way to describe what they're doing.
Yes, because the other way it is described is, I think, something that nobody understands.
You don't think it's catchphrasy?
I don't, because it's in the statute, and I don't. The other term is deferred deposit lender.
I saw that.
Nobody knows what that is.
Are you saying payday lender is in the existing statute?
It is.
Mm-hmm. Well, payday loan is.
And I think payday lender. Okay. Maybe it's just payday loan. Payday is definitely in the existing statute.
Another question as to the measure. The way the staff draft said prohibiting, any combination of interest, fees, and charges, it appears to me that your measure is actually getting rid of any fees or interest other than the finance charge. And limiting the finance charge then to 36%.
It is. I think what one could argue is that you could have fees and charges that are inside that 36%, but they can't be on top of.
Okay.
Because right now there's a finance charge that is an interest rate, and then those fees and charges are on top of.
Right, which that's kind of my point. There are no fees or charges in addition now to just the annual percentage rate of 36% on a finance charge.
So
that
we
the statute
could
will allow.
Right, so we could say reducing allowable charges by prohibiting Or by...
You could just say reducing allowable charges to an effective annual percentage rate of 36%.
On payday loans.
Yeah, and just get rid of...
Yeah, I think that would actually make it clear. If so long as we had the reducing allowable charges language in there so that it makes clear that we're doing away with the others.
Do we need effective? Or just, oh yeah, you were proposing get rid of that too.
I don't think we do need an, we need, I do not believe we need effective. Mm-hmm. In this context, I don't.
Yeah.
So what was the proposed language limiting them to?
Reducing allowable charges to an annual percentage rate of. So you need to get rid of that by on the end of line three, I think.
I would propose we move on payday loans up to follow allowable charges. Reducing allowable charges on payday loans to an annual percentage rate of 36%.
And then do you think we could strike the concerning limitations? I mean, now we've just described the entire measure and...
Have we? Because like I said, I'm still... And maybe I just don't understand it well enough whether what we're putting into 3.1.121 falls within the reducing the allowable charge or if that's actually different.
But wouldn't that be now in the initial clause?
Yeah, so, if we leave it in. It's just kind of strange to have an initial clause and then a trailer with one thing. We're not even describing the other thing because...
But. And one other point, I think, to make clear that it's a maximum annual percentage of 36%, it's not fixed at 30. So
let's say maximum.
To a
maximum.
Or you could say, I guess, you could say to an annual percentage rate of 36% or less. Maybe that's an easier way to say it.
So do we think we need to describe what's going on in 5.3.1.121?
No, I don't think it
don't think it's that.
Is really central to the measure. It's just,
okay.
I don't know.
All right.
If you're fine, well, you got something? Go ahead.
There's suggestion that that a maximum annual percentage rate of 36% would be clearer.
Yeah, I like that better, actually.
A maximum or no more than 36%?
No more.
Or no more than.
Instead
to
of
no more than an annual percentage rate.
An annual percentage rate of no more than 36%.
Of no, yeah, that would work. I guess that's three different ways of saying the same thing, pretty much.
So now it reads an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning limitations on payday lenders and in connection therewith reducing allowable charges on payday loans to an annual percentage rate of no more than 36%.
We're fine with that.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Want to move it?
Do we need a motion? Yeah. I move that we set the title for a proposed initiative 2017-18, number 126, as it shows on the screen and as was just read into the record.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, and that takes us to 2017-2018, number 133, policy changes pertaining to state income taxes.
And we need to take a break so that the proponents of those initiatives can sign their affidavits.
Okay.
So if we can just take 5 minutes.
Sure.
Now we're all set.
Sure. All right. We are back on the record with 2017-2018, number 133, policy changes pertaining to state income taxes. The proponents present. You can just say they're here for the record, Mr. Gruskin. That's fine.
Mark Gruskin, on behalf of the proponents who are here and have completed the necessary affidavits.
Right. And do you want to just start by telling us what you believe the single subject of your measure is?
This initiatives 133 through 144 all deal with reallocating the state income tax burden in Colorado. They do so through creating the wherewithal for adding a second tier of income tax by amending Tabor, and then actually amending the tax code to do that. And in the same process, also as a fiscal matter under the tax code, create an earned income tax credit for qualifying taxpayers.
All right. Why don't we start with questions on jurisdictional issues?
Yes. Mr. Gruskin, the proponents amended this measure following the review and comment hearing so that the tax rate increase applies not only to the taxable income of any individual, but also every estate and trust. I don't believe that was in response to any comments at the review and comment hearing. I'm somewhat concerned about that as a jurisdictional matter.
I'm looking at the review and comment memo right now. The issue of the applicability of the new tax rate was addressed, and it was really a technical amendment to make it clear that there was not an exemption for trusts and estates, since the existing rate applies to them as well. And if you'll just give me a moment with the review and comment memo.
Do you have a copy of
the
So, Mr.
Gellender, the comment was made that required us, the proponents, to establish a new subsection B in order to, rather than push everything into 1.7A, the comment was made that we would be better off having created section 1.7B in order to create the new tax rate. So having done that, we simply replicated what was in 1.7A that was inclusive of the tax rate that applies to individuals, estates, and trusts. And to the extent that the heading of the statute, 3922-104, specifically relates to income tax imposed on individuals, estates, and trusts, we think that that is certainly indicative that there is a scheme that applies across the board rather than somehow carving individuals out separately from the rates that apply.
Okay.
And the issues that arose in terms of legislative staff suggesting that, and let me just make sure that I'm referring to the correct question. For there was a 1.8 in the original draft, but it was not as expansive as it needed to be, which is why we replicated the language that we were basically told would apply. And I'll represent that the issue was addressed with staff as a function of the questions. Certainly question five implies that the applicability of the rate.
All right, so point being is you feel that there was a question regarding essentially the formatting in which you did the initiative, which had you make amendments to the new subsection 1.8 that were similar to existing subsection 1.7, and that the language essentially conformed to that. Okay. Thank you.
As I recall the hearing, and based upon our changes, we were not inclined to make changes that expanded the measure such that the jurisdiction of the board would be implicated.
Okay.
Any other questions on jurisdiction, single subject?
No.
No? Rooney? No? You want to make a motion then?
Yes, I move that we find that proposed initiative 2718 number 133 has a single subject and that we have jurisdiction to set a title.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. That takes us to the language. And
oh, you might not be surprised, but I have a...
So does he. Now we have competing...
Oh, well,
let's...
No,
let's,
just kidding. Bring them up.
If I may.
Do you have another one of yours?
Yes.
We can trade.
I don't show changes. It's just there.
Thank you.
Do we need a 55% that strikes that?
Oh, yeah.
It's...
What?
What would be the best way?
Yeah, it's exclusively on.
Do you want to study for a bit?
Yeah, we need to talk about the 50.
Oh, the 55%.
Yeah.
Right. Sorry.
Yeah. So do you have any position on that, Mr. Gerson?
No, language is added to the Constitution here, and therefore it is not a 55% amendment.
That appears to be correct. I would move that we find the proposed initiative 2017-18, number 133, although it does amend the Colorado Constitution, does so only by deleting existing language and therefore requires only a 50% vote for approval.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right.
Now we're to the language.
So I apologize that there's a little bit of confusion here because I've struck a phrase that applies to some other initiatives on the back. But hopefully what you've got is language that is reflective. I know what you've got is language that is reflective of 133, and we'll be able to walk you through the differences in each and why there might be slightly different language elsewhere.
Right. How do you want to do this?
Well, I think it's a question of what we want to start from. So I think the staff draft is sort of the most comprehensive, and we can cut down from that. Mine is a bit less so, and it looks like the proponent's proposal, as with a lot of the back stuff, the stuff towards the end finds it not central, it looks like, and is striking a fair amount more. So it just sort of depends what base document you want to use.
I think ours is a little shorter than yours, and it's a lot shorter than the staff draft.
Yeah. Well, let's just start with the staff draft, and then we'll just kind of ping back and forth. Okay. So do you want to start with the fiscal impact? So we've got to put in the number. Do you have any comment on?
We actually submitted some economic data and a projection to staff, and they considered it and thought that based on their modeling, the number might be a little higher. So we think that the number that the staff came up with might be a little aggressive. Okay. But I don't know. This is a consultant to the proponents, Adam Rubin. I don't know if the board would like to hear from him. He's done some economic assessment.
Well, I mean, I guess at this point, this is to going to title drafting, not, you know, the abstract itself.
Right.
Might as well take the information. You know, I'm probably more likely to rely on the staff draft number, but
yes,
your call.
No, let's. I mean, we need it for title, so
okay.
Well, let's go ahead and hear what your.
Well, our assessment was about $1.437 billion.
I think that's right.
Based on modeling, I think the staff projected into 2019, which is when this would be effective. So, even so, there's feels a little more aggressive, but I know this is not a time other than for the Tabor estimate where we can really quibble.
So let's talk about that number. The $1.437 billion, now is that the total? Is that the number represented just by the income tax rate increase? Is it the increase plus the repeal of the existing earned income tax credit, where does that number come from?
It's just the increase. So the repeal would be different, and I saw that your language talked about a netting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're a step beyond, you're probably two steps beyond where we are in terms of assessing that.
Right. I guess my question is do you feel that the number in the blank should be the total amount, simply the amount of the increase of the rate, the amount generated of revenue generated by the rate increase, or should any other policy changes be incorporated into that number as well? Since this measure has essentially a large rate increase that generates a lot of revenue, a little bit of revenue generated by the repeal of the existing credit, and then a fairly large decrease in revenue generated by the new credit.
I'm trying
to figure out how you,
right.
how you feel the number, the blank should, what the blank should say.
Well, I think if the blank reflected your analysis, which is, I admitted, was two steps beyond ours, it would probably be the most accurate cumulative fiscal impact.
Okay. Because one of the concerns is, and the reason I drafted in a way that it's, my proposal separates it out essentially, is for a couple of reasons. One, so that the increase, because it's an interesting thing, so you're increasing on one group of people and of course decreasing on a different group of people that won't overlap. And it feels like Tabor, you know, Tabor doesn't really say anything about what to do in the blank with offsetting decreases. It just says put in the amount of the increase. So I wonder if the number in the blank sort of needs to be the entire increase,
right.
But that gives sort of an unfair reflection of the total impact of the measures, which is why I then tried to add other language elsewhere.
I think your language covers all the legal bases in terms of the title wouldn't be subject to a Tabor challenge. And my concern is that if adopted, then the measure isn't subject to some sort of post-election Tabor challenge.
Right. And I don't think we want to also get into a situation where we have a net number in the blank and then it's deemed that everything over the net number needs to be refunded. And then they do that calculation based on the gross number.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
We're fine with your analysis. We think it's the most informative for voters too.
Okay.
All right.
So I guess now we should hear from the expert on their number.
Right.
I apologize.
No, that's fine. Yeah. We were just saying we could hear from your expert on your number.
I don't think we have anything to add, really.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Do you want to hear from the state, or are you okay?
That's up to you. I mean, I think I can just go on
what
they put in here.
I am too, but
I think the only question we have to answer for ourselves, whichever number we start with as the base to use, is so I'm looking at this is actually the wrong one, but somewhere. I've got the other one. Okay, somewhere I have the other one. The 133. Anyways.
There's another series that increases a different level.
Right. So on page 4, there's boxes with the general fund revenue impacts. So for Tabor, we have to do the first full fiscal year, so that would be the middle column. And I think the only question is whether we include in the blank just the top row, the $1,850,000,000, or that plus the amount generated by the repeal. To me, the repeal is a tax policy change, not a increase in, you know, that ballot language isn't required, the ballot language with the blank for policy changes. So I think probably the best way is to use the front number, then calculate in the repeal number when we're netting it out and explaining it afterwards.
I think that's right. I mean,
okay.
I think that fits the Tabor format required.
Okay. Just want to make a record of that. So what number do we want to use?
So isn't that the 185?
If we use council's number, it's the 185. Their number was one something. I'd be inclined to use council's number. One in the end, ultimately, their number will be what's in here based on the blue book.
Yeah.
Secondarily, I think as a higher number, there's less risk of us actually coming in over it and having to do refunds.
Although we've debruced the...
We've
only debruced this revenue stream.
Right.
So you're right. So there could be other circumstances that would...
Yeah. Okay. So, all right, so I got the number in there. And then, Steve, I think what I would propose then is we got the comma after annually, then followed by with a net increase of, and it's less than that. So now I have to do math.
Go ahead,
please.
Is it the bottom number in that same column of that same table?
Well, no, I think what we wanted represent is the bottom. Well, actually, yes, I think it is. I don't know. We all try to get a head nod from Ms. Mullis. Natalie, is the bottom number nets out everything? Perfect. Okay, that one then.
And my only request is that this be worded such that it doesn't look like there's
two increases.
Exactly. So that there's some contrast, either in terms of rather than using with, which kind of suggests addition, although.
Or something like with the net increase being, or with the net.
I don't know how meaningful the net.
Or the
reference to net increase is going to be for voters. But if we can use some sort of, but or although or...
While other taxes decrease.
Okay, actually, I think we can have about this. With that amount being decreased to $551,100,000
that works.
By...
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh no, that's just so confusing way to start.
No, that it is.
But
I think we do need to put, if we're going to go with this model, I do think we need to put it up at the top in one place.
You don't think we can put it in the trailer?
I think we can. I think in terms of giving, quality notice to people,
Well, shouldn't we say what it's being decreased because of?
So with the state's total increased revenue, well, additional revenue being decreased too, so that it's clear that it's not that tax that's decreasing, I'm sorry.
Right. The problem is by having to say an amendment to two different things, you're separating it out so far from the reference to the credit that it's hard to track. I do agree with that. I mean, if we want to put... the decrease line down further and just have the increase up front. I mean, and have that language, you know, closer to the credit.
Well, could we just say other with other tax credits? I don't know. It just seems weird to say it's going to be decreased and not say why.
Right. We do say why. The problem is it's just way
down. Way down there, yeah. Kind of. Like, some people are going to be lost by then. Or stop reading.
I do think it's pretty confusing the way it's laid out right there. So that'd be increased, but then decreased.
I mean, we could say with other tax credits and then do the delta amount. Not say the total, but instead say with other tax credits of 1.3 or whatever that number would be.
Well, would it be possible, rather than netting it out, to use the typical table languages you're using, include the language that, or some riff thereon of the staff draft about, you know, by an amendment to the Colorado Constitution and a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes, but after the earned income tax credit, put that results in a decrease of state taxes of $1.389 billion.
Well, except you need to account for the repeal. I mean, it'd be a net of those last two numbers, right?
Right, 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 right. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sorry. I forgot. I just overlooked that piece, but you're 100% right.
And we don't have to put the net in there, I guess, is what I'm saying, is instead of putting the net, we could just put that difference of like, what is the credit? The credit is
$1,388,900,000 is the.
Say, with earned net.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just sort of a matter of what you want to emphasize. My initial thought practice, I do a lot of Tabor stuff, is, you know, the total tax increase. But in this measure, especially where the people paying and the people getting are two entirely separate groups, and it makes more sense to say increased, you know, we don't say it, but have the whole number for the people paying and then have the whole number for the people getting. Maybe that is a better approach.
Yeah, and then people can do the math about what the total is. I mean, what the net is. It seems like putting the net in there is confusing.
Okay.
Well, we would totally on your page. Okay. So, you know.
Steve, I think what we're going to do is probably take that out up front, with that amount being decreased to, and then down below we'll get the credit amount in somewhere.
Yeah. Okay.
That's going to be annoying.
You can read over there.
Well, maybe you can. All right. Do we want to work off of Mr. Griskin's language to start shortening things up for a while?
So we get bored with it. Which won't be long, but that's okay.
I'm only here another half hour, so whatever we can get in. Let's get one question done.
Yeah, let's.
Well, and I think there's actually a fair amount of crossover between the changes that Mr. Gellender made and the changes that we made, so.
Okay. So I think what I might propose, do we like the concerning an increased state income tax rate? That's one of Mr. Griskin's changes.
Yeah, I think that's good.
That's right. And we'll replace certain. He just had it stricken. I would suggest the word non-corporate in place of certain. Since we're not imposing the higher rate on any corporate taxpayers, that might be something people want to know. Let me know if there's objections to that idea.
I mean, we say later on, we specifically mention individuals, trusts, and estates.
Well, this is actually our alternative suggestion.
Right, I know.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's obviously your call as to whether or not it needs to be in the single subject statement or whether or not the information is sufficient. We think actually just the threshold at which the tax increase is more important for that single subject statement.
I mean, another minor issue here is we have an increased income tax rate for taxpayers earning more than $500,000. I mean, that's true. Does it make it clear that it's not on all of their money? You know, it's only on their income over $500,000 that's actually getting a higher rate.
So that is in the phrase that is about halfway down that starts increasing the state income tax rate from 4.63% to 11.8% on taxable income greater than $500,000. So that is, at least as we've changed it, we do make it clear that it's the marginal rate. But I think that you could also say an increased state income tax rate on income greater than $500,000 in that single subject phrase, rather than use taxpayers. And then I suppose if you want to use non-corporate income, that would encompass your thought and ours as well, and use a relatively few number of words.
Sorry, I'm a little...
Oh, no, it's fine.
Lost. Where are we now? Just go with this for a while.
Okay.
See what we get.
So, Jason, you didn't use the in order to language, right?
No.
I didn't really like that language. It seems like we're just doing two different things.
I kind of highlighted the offset. So my single subject was concerning an increase in the state income tax rate for non-corporate taxpayers as partly offset by an expanded state earned income tax credit for individual taxpayers.
Yeah. I like that. Is there a difference between the non-corporate and individual?
Just to encompass the estates and trusts.
Okay. I think I like that one better than in order to, because... Yeah. One doesn't have to come from the other.
I agree.
It's just two different things.
What's that?
Can I?
That's my. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I thought I'd gotten one of those.
Oh, no. That's fine. Wait.
Monday morning, too.
Oh.
Okay. You want to do yours? Get rid of the in order to?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if she means all of mine or not. I think.
Well, I just meant
right.
That part, yeah.
Well, Steve looks like he's... No, I see what he's doing.
That is...
I'm starting with a concerning...
So I think we can kind of get where you are. It's the we've used increase on lines 1 and line 3 now. So is it possible that line 3 said statutes concerning an added state income tax rate on non-corporate income over $500,000? Because ultimately, it's really not the state income tax rate that is partly offset by the earned income tax credit. It's the revenue flowing from. So we think that the phrase as constructed
right.
doesn't entirely, I mean, it's got the thought process, but technically it's probably not accurate. So or an increase in the state income tax rate for non-corporate taxpayers on income over $500,000.
I like that. And I think we can get rid of some trailer language when we do it that way, which might help.
And then you could just say and strike that is partly offset by.
Sure.
And then continue with the expanded EITC.
I do think if we want to do that, we probably want to say something like, in an expanded earned income tax credit for individual taxpayers that offsets a portion of the tax increase or something like that to tie it right there, because otherwise it looks like the credit's being factored into the $1,850,000,000.
Yeah.
I think that would work.
Okay. So after line 5, individual tax payers, I think that that partly offsets the tax increase. Okay. Still doesn't really solve the problem, but
which problem?
Oh, just making it look like the income tax credit is part of the
your boy's
pen. For the number in the blank.
Oh,
that's what I'm trying to address.
Well, because it's not Tabor mandated, isn't there the flexibility to put it in the trailing language in the title in terms of the amount of the offset?
Yeah, no, the amount, right. I'm just saying so before the comments, our single subject says it's right, state taxes shall be increased this number by, and then the by is both the increase and the credit, but in fact, the credit's not contributing to the increase, it's actually offsetting it. I'm trying to figure out, but I think we still sort of need it in the.
Well, I think the increase is by the amendment, and then this is what it's concerning. So we're not saying that the increase is by the.
Okay, that makes me feel better.
Is through better than by? Because you've got you've got and between the Colorado Constitution and the Colorado Vice Statute change. But maybe not. Maybe it's exactly the problem that you've isolated.
It's probably fine. Yeah, let's move on, at least for now.
We're with you there.
Sorry. All right, in connection therewith. All right, everybody's happy with repealing the constitutional requirement.
We tried to shorten the phrase a little bit by not employing the reference to federal taxable income.
Yes. I think is the next clause, I think their language works just fine. You guys don't seem to care about the inflation adjustment. Anyone think that rises to the level of being central that we should include it?
I kind of like to have it in there because $500,000 is just for 1 year, right?
Yeah.
But we don't oppose it. We took our language title shortening pills this morning and went crazy. So.
Okay, so. So I think you just use their language. Except right after 500,000, do a comma, annually adjusted for inflation.
Our screen just keeps.
Imagine how I feel.
You have a little better view. And you have staff coming in to check on you. Your
welfare. You're right, I've got it easy up here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we definitely take out this annual adjusting the 11.8% tax rate for inflation.
What?
We're taking out something.
We are?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I thought Glenn liked that.
No, we put in the annually adjusted for inflation elsewhere.
Oh,
but okay. We're not actually adjusting the rate. We're adjusting the amount. So
that's what I thought. That'd be strange to adjust them.
We just lost something important.
The expanding the state earned income tax?
Yeah.
No, but that's what we did.
Yeah.
That was our language.
Oh, we moved it.
Yeah.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. It's okay. You have to spend a few hundred hours here.
Today.
Picking up.
I didn't know that, or didn't think that number and age of the dependents was critical, but again, that's one of those issues where if you think it reads better, it's. one issue that I don't know how many times we want to use the phrase earned income tax credit, but in the revision that I handed you, it had been stricken in certain places, but not stricken in other places. So, for instance, line 14, I struck it, but line 17, it's still there, and I just didn't know if that was confusing.
Well, it's the only credit we have, so I'm probably pretty much inclined to just say credit after the first time.
Okay. If we're good with that, too. Yeah, or tax credit.
So if the board wants to move the changes that are up so far, discuss them, this might be a good place for us to get those incorporated so that we can collapse
yeah.
a little further.
You want to?
I can hardly see them.
You can go around and read them.
Come sit over here on our side.
He can't. There's no microphone.
Would the board be open to
put it? There it is. Read fast.
Would the board be open to including the modifier of tax before the word credit on line 14 and then taking out earned income and just leaving tax credit on line 17?
That's fine with me.
I mean, we can keep messing with this. I'd be inclined to just accept every change he's put in right now just so we can work off of
Let's
something
do
we
that.
Can
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so what line are we on now?
Go up to the top, Steve. So I just...
Since we mentioned non-corporate earlier, do we need the reference to individuals, estates, and trusts on line 8?
Well, apparently those are different, right? Individual is different than non-corporate?
No, individual is, but individual, estate, and trust is, that's, I think, everything that's covered by non-corporate.
Right, as far as I know. So it's a different category.
Can I just ask, Mr. Gonder, would an LLC be treated as corporate entity for tax purposes or a partnership or a, I just want to make sure that non-corporate doesn't have such a specified meaning for the tax code.
Oh, I guess I was using it pretty generically. I guess anything like that's possible, although I think those things are pass-throughs usually, but I was just trying to use an umbrella term to make sure we covered everything.
No, I understand that. I'm trying to fend off a motion for rehearing, so.
Yeah.
Parallel.
I'm not going to do it.
I just want to make sure that I do think that the umbrella term communicates to voters fundamentally what they want to know, but I just thought I'd raise that.
So we're all fine taking the monthly basis thing out. I'm fine with it. But just asking around.
I think so.
Okay.
We weren't sure that the question of whether or not using expenses, using this revenue for expenses was a central feature, but it seemed relevant, and it is also
the difference
one of the ways, exactly. So that's why we left that in rather than having them calculate the amount of money, which we don't think is quite as important.
But you're not going to circulate more than one, are you?
No, we're only going to circulate one, but some of these measures will set a 5% cap on administrative expenses, so it's a way that these can be differentiated.
They're on line 15. Do we need to say Department of Revenue since we took out the...
Yeah.
I'm just not sure it's central.
Chair, is it your feeling that the sort of everything they struck out here at the bottom, all of that you would see as non-central, the electronic methods to transmit refunds, all that rulemaking stuff?
Yeah, I don't see that as central to, I mean, this is.
The notice basically saying we're not just going to make this credit available, we're going to try to actively sort of find people and tell them about it. I do think that the last piece they've taken out about the refund mechanism, we probably should keep in.
Specifying the refund mechanism?
Yeah, so what this is the state income tax rate gets reduced as a Tabor refund mechanism under certain circumstances.
Yeah, I think
we have to reduce enough. I think the people making over $500,000 would like to know that they're not sharing in that refund mechanism effectively.
Right. Well, that's kind of the debrucing type.
Existing refund mechanism.
I mean, what do you think? You have a lot of this stuff in. I just didn't really feel like it was.
I have. Well, what I did is sort of consolidated and shortened up the rulemaking bit. Yeah, I think. I mean, if the proponents don't feel like the monthly disbursement thing is significant, I don't think I do either.
Glenn, you have an opinion on that? The monthly disbursement?
No.
You don't think it's central? Okay. I think we could take that out then. I didn't think that the department's use of the money was all that central. They're not going to be able to use it unless it's appropriated anyway.
The
5%.
The 5%.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, just for clarification, for my purposes, on the record, what's the
the whole calculation of the money attributable to the rate increase, what's, is that just for purposes of calculating how much they can spend on administrative expenses, or is there any other reason you guys have that in there?
We think that there ought to be some sort of accountability. So actually having a, once this gets adopted, having some sort of clarity about the amount of the credit that's being granted. But also, you can't determine for purposes of our 5% provisions that number without knowing what the total number is, needs to be.
Because one concern I've had about this measure, it didn't rise to a single subject level. It may, and I think we're sort of addressing it to a point with the netting, is what happened, there's all this money. I think, would we say a $550 million net increase after we paid out the credits? What happens to all that money?
Well, I mean, at this point, the legislature has the authority, we think, to change the amount of the tax credit if they want to. We would anticipate that the linkage between the revenue source and the only expenditure's purpose would be clear to the legislature. But obviously, we can't and are not looking to tie their hands.
And, you know, for reasons like that, you know, I don't think this is similar, I did look at it, to, you know, the outsell the Bruce lines of cases where the local tax cuts weren't deemed necessarily properly connected to the cut in services. This being like a flip side of the coin of that.
Right.
And I didn't see that happening. But I do wonder, for notice purposes, it seems to me that there might be a lot of voters who say, well, if we're raising, raising taxes on the rich to give those taxes back to the poor, we're good with that. But if we're raising taxes on the rich to give some of them back to the poor and then let the state spend an extra $500 million, maybe we're not okay with that. And I just wanted to know what you thought about that and if that's the sort of thing, and for the board as well, that we need to try to talk about or think about.
We
felt like the analogy, because I was thinking titling it a Robin Hood type thing. Except for that.
We're not all
going opposite directions.
We thought it was implied in 133 through 138, and then in 139 through 144, we included language about how the revenue must be used for the
right, and I saw that, and I wondered if that was the concern you had in doing that, or
it was
what the purpose of that difference
was. It was just taking what is clearly implied and making it expressed.
Okay. So we can carry on.
Yes.
Yeah. Wanted to make a record of that and also, you know, determine if it's something that we need to somehow give notice of. And I mean, I think with partly offset, you know, maybe we have.
I think we've said it. So. I think maybe that's for the campaign. I think we've said what it does.
Fair enough. All right, back to. Should we just? Do you have everything marked on in there now? Mm-hmm. Why don't we just accept it for now, and so we can function.
No, I think this is referenced.
And put into like a 6-point font so we can actually read it all at once.
No.
Thank you.
We got like 2 minutes before it's off the screen.
If that.
I didn't think.
Read fast. There it is. The whole thing's up there. I feel like I should read it since it's up there.
Can we ask about one phrase that you've added?
But if the screen disappears.
It begins on So I think that you lost a semicolon on line 12 between credit and specifying.
How dare you lose semicolon?
So the following phrase that begins specifying, what exactly do you think you're describing, or are you describing, By that phrase, just so I...
The specifying phrase?
Yeah.
Okay, so right now there's a Tabor refund mechanism, and our fiscal expert in the back can explain it right if I don't, but basically applies when there's a requirement that Tabor, that excess state revenues be required under Tabor, and I believe it's above a certain threshold, the refund mechanism that's done is a temporary income tax rate reduction. So we're acknowledging that your measure says the 11.8% rate reduction doesn't get reduced, only the 4.63 existing does. And I think it probably should be included because at least one subset of voters that's subject to that 11.8% tax might want to know that if Tabor refunds come through that mechanism, they're not getting a piece of that pie. Or, well, I take that back. I guess they are on the first 500,000 of income and then not after that. You know, and I'd probably be willing to, you know, listen to arguments that that's not a central feature, but I think people tend to be pretty sensitive to some of these sort of direct Tabor impact kinds of things in their refunds. So,
yeah, exactly. I'm just not sure that anybody who makes over 500,000 is going to have voted for it except for that. I just don't see where that person is.
I'm afraid I would not know the mind of such a person.
Well, I wouldn't either, but if I'm going to vote to increase my taxes, I'm not going to change my mind because when the refund comes, I don't get.
And we think, in fact, that just because it is a fairly complex Tabor concept that I had to make sure I knew exactly which part of the measure you were addressing, that voters could read that and say, oh, so it's an ephemeral tax credit and it's going to disappear at certain times for under certain conditions, and I don't know if I'm subject to those conditions. So I guess...
Yeah, I think it's a little bit... I know what we're trying to describe, but I think it's a little bit confusing. It's not getting much bang for our buck, I guess. I just don't think it's telling anybody. If I don't make 500,000 and I fundamentally believe people who do should pay more, I'm probably not also going to change my mind because they're not going to be in on the refund over 500,000. So,
fair point.
Yeah.
I think that's a delete that one. All right.
You want to accept it, Steve, and then I'm going to read it while it's up there just so that we have something in the record. State taxes shall be increased $1,850,700,000 annually by an amendment to the Colorado Constitution and a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning an increase in the state income tax rates for non-corporate taxpayers on income over $500,000 and an expanded state earned income tax credit for individual taxpayers that partly offsets the tax increase. And in connection therewith, repealing the constitutional requirement that all income be taxed at one rate, increasing the state income tax rate from 4.63% to 11.8% on taxable income greater than $500,000 annually adjusted for inflation for individuals, estates, and trusts, allowing most individual taxpayers with incomes up to $70,000 to claim a tax credit of up to $2,000, depending on the taxpayer's income and dependents, providing a tax credit to qualifying caregivers and students, allowing the Department of Revenue to use a portion of the new revenue to pay expenses to administer the credit, and allowing the state to retain and spend all money from the tax increase as a voter-approved revenue change.
Okay. So a couple of things. First, I think if we're going to do the annually adjusted for inflation for the 500,000, we should probably do it for the 70,000 as well.
Okay.
Even though it's repetitive. So, Steve, line 9.
I'm sorry, what was the change on line 9?
Line 9, annually. After 70,000, comma, annually adjusted for inflation, comma. And just before I forget, I think Mr. Groost had a good idea earlier. So lines 2 and 3, which we lost, I think we could say concerning an increased state income tax rate. I think we lost that when we switched over to my single subject. How central do we think it is, the potential maximum amount of the credit and its sort of variability depending on taxpayer, I mean, kind of the taxpayer's income independence?
Oh, the 70,000? I mean, I think if we just say allowing most.
Well, I think saying how much, I think it's pretty important to say sort of how much of an income you can have to get something.
Yeah, and the 2,000.
So you do think the 2,000 is important?
If it's, yeah, I think.
Speak a little louder, please.
Yeah, he was asking how central it is. Pretty much everything after annually adjusted for inflation on line 9 through maybe somewhere on line, end of line 10 maybe. So I think the up to 2,000 is central.
Okay.
I'm not sure if depending on the taxpayer's income and dependence, I mean, that should be pretty. I mean, if it's up to, and if it's most, then they should know that's dependent on something. I don't know what else it would be dependent on. I still don't think the whole Department of Revenue using some of it is very central either.
Is that still,
But I'm fine with it. I'm just not sure anybody really.
We're fine with it. I'm
good either way.
That's a decision of the board.
If you like it, we can keep it.
Jason, there was some reason you thought it was important to have that in.
Not overly so. I mean, I know. And so they're only going to circulate one, so I don't need it as a distinguishing feature between any of them.
Right.
I think if the proponents don't feel it's central to include it on the ones that limit it to a percentage that's important to them, then I'm fine with deleting it entirely.
I think our sense is we include it in the language just to provide you with the option. We think the fact that the measure pays for itself is something people would like to know, but they'll probably get that information in the blue book, and it's not something they need to know about the purpose of the changes, because it's not, strictly speaking, a fiscal policy change. Right? It's a government expenditure change. So we think it's secondary.
But really, they can use it to pay for itself. It doesn't mandate that it has to pay for itself, right? It's like you can use up to 5%.
That is in a different measure.
Oh, okay.
The specific language here is Uh, portion of monies may be used to pay reasonable and necessary. So you,
yeah,
you're right.
It's still got to be appropriated. I don't know that it really necessarily is going to pay for itself.
So for the qualifying caregivers and students, as I understand this, this can be, it's essentially sort of a separate earned income tax credit in that if there's a person who's a caregiver and also has, don't tell, they can get like a second credit. Could you?
Yeah, tell us what that's
about. I just want to understand the sort of the relationship between the caregiver and student credit and the general one.
It's not a second or additional credit. It's an alternative calculation for the amount of their credit that applies for qualified caregivers and students with zero income or very low earned income. Under, I think the fiscal estimate puts it at $9,803. So above that point, or above some point for sort of moderate and higher income people who are eligible for the credit, the fact of their earned income determines the amount of their credit. You don't get anything extra or different for being a caregiver or student. But if you have zero income, you wouldn't qualify based on earned income. But if you're a qualified caregiver or student, you do get a credit. Or if it's very low, you wouldn't get very much based on earned income, but you do get an amount as a caregiver or student.
Okay. So it's just, so it's an alternative. No one's going to get...
No one gets two.
Okay.
One second. Do you want to say providing an alternate tax credit?
Yeah. My eyes haven't adjusted to the different distance yet. So
yeah, so on line 11, we'd say providing an alternate tax credit.
Technically, it is still the earned income tax credit. The only thing that varies for them is the amount and the fact that they're eligible for it. So it's not technically a different credit or a second credit. It's just they qualify for the credit that is being discussed in this title.
Well, do you just want to leave it out? Because it, we still are.
Well, they're all individual taxpayers anyway.
So, yeah. Maybe it doesn't really add anything.
Because if we start getting the details of how this thing's calculated, which, you know, require charts and tables and things, then it's a large rabbit hole.
And is the amount the same of that alternative way of calculating it still up to 2,000?
I'm sorry.
For the caregivers and students, it's still accurate to say
it's up to 2,000?
They can claim it up to $2,000?
Yes.
Okay.
But I thought you were saying to take out the phrase an alternate, not to take out that whole line about caregivers and students.
No, we were just saying they're all individual taxpayers, so why call them out specifically?
We would suggest that that is central to understanding, that that is a new innovation in the administration of the earned income tax credit, because for the first time, someone who has zero earned income but qualifies through this other mechanism could qualify to get the credit. So it's not just, oh, the amount is slightly different for those folks. It's that they qualify for at some income levels, they qualify, but with a different amount. And at zero earned income, someone only qualifies if they are a caregiver and a student. So we think that that's really central to the, for voters to understand.
So if you have zero, you only qualify if you're a caregiver or a student.
That's right.
I mean, zero is still up to 70,000 though. I mean, still.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar, terribly familiar with this credit and what is allowed in existing law. Do people without children, so do caregivers and students, can they claim an earned income tax credit now?
If they are treated today like anybody else, it's only determined by the amount of their income. So they don't, there's no special provision under existing law for caregivers or students. That's a new feature of this measure.
Gotcha.
Do you want to put it in then?
Yeah, probably.
All right, let's put it back in. All right.
Given that, do you feel like an alternate is
No, because
important
it's
to
not,
have in there.
It's not really alternate. It's.
But I don't think it's an anymore. Then I think we would just say allowing the tax credit.
Yeah.
To qualified caregivers and students.
Providing the tax credit, is that?
That's good. Oh,
yeah. Or allowing the.
That's what I'd say. Yeah, allowing the tax credit.
With no income, is that what you're getting at? Or oh, I guess it would be with some.
I think just qualifying.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And I would say two, not four. Keep the two. Okay.
You want to accept that?
Sure.
All right. I'm going to read it again. Because it's there. State taxes shall be increased $1,850,700,000 annually by an amendment to the Colorado Constitution and a change to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning an increased state income tax rate for non-corporate taxpayers on income over $500,000 and an expanded state earned income tax credit for individual taxpayers that partly offsets the tax increase, and in connection therewith, repealing the constitutional requirement that all income tax be taxed at one rate, increasing the state income tax rate from 4.63% to 11.8% on taxable income greater than $500,000 annually adjusted for inflation for individuals, estates, and trusts, allowing most individual taxpayers with incomes up to $70,000 annually adjusted for inflation to claim a tax credit of up to $2,000, allowing the tax credit to qualifying caregivers and students, and allowing the state to retain and spend all money from the tax increase as a voter-approved revenue change.
The only thing I would have left is we never did sort of add back any sort of kind of net total of the offset. We just said partly offsets the tax increase. If we wanted to do that, we should do that.
So that offset was going to be what page is that?
Page four. So it's
So we would say offset the 1,388,000, right?
Yeah. So okay. And there's the plus. So we're reducing the number, though, is because we also have the repeal, which is an addition. So it's a.
Yeah, it's like offset. Well, 1,290 or something.
Yeah, 1,296, I think. And if anyone eyeballs that and tells me I'm wrong, that would be great.
Can I just ask, since this would be in the body of the ballot title, it wouldn't really be reflecting the language of the measure, it would be describing an effect of the measure. And do we want to go there? Do you want to go there? Because...
Yeah, that's kind of up to you.
I guess what I'd say is, you know, you're the proponents, so if you're comfortable just having a bigger number in this than its real net effect, then I don't know that it's our place to tell you you shouldn't do that, but, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily what you'd want to do.
Right. I guess our sense is that if it is in that introductory, if there's a way to do it in the introductory clause without confusing matters, that's where I think people will put them together.
I guess the other challenge we face is that we can update the blank based on when they do a final blue book. I don't know that we can update
another number. Then we can't update the language, right.
So maybe we just partly offset, we'll let it be there. It'll go in the blue book and tables and people can figure it out, and that's the best we can do.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
Thank you, though, for the thought. That it's helpful.
Pat, do we think we're good with it?
Yeah.
All right. I would move that we set the proposed title. I'm sorry, that we set the title for Initiative 2017-18, number 133, as we have rather extensively amended it and as it now appears on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. On that note,
I gotta go. So, Glenn's fault he wanted to start late.
It's the Court of Appeals' fault.
Yeah, it's the Court of Appeals' fault.
They scheduled by our.
All right. You want to take over, Jason?
I don't see other volunteers. This may take a moment. And Steve, can we go off for just 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Thanks.